Welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. I'm Jason Silverman, a pediatric GI doc in Edmonton, Alberta, and this episode I have the pleasure of being joined by the great,
the one and only
Tamara Hajat from Cincinnati. How are you doing, Tamara?
I'm good. How are you, Jason?
I'm well. So we are right now, we've been talking a lot about air quality lately because for anybody that doesn't know, we're recording this in late June and the world is burning here in Canada and in some parts of the US, and it's affecting everybody. But I guess the positive flip side of that is part of that is because the weather is so nice and hot and things like that. And so it is summer here. And I know our kids are done school. As of yesterday was their first day not in school. I know south of the border kids have been out for a while, but here the end of the school year is late June, but then they don't go back until the first week of September. So things are shifted a little bit later here, but so they're loving their life. They're lounging around, and we had to talk to them about how no, mom and dad don't actually get, you know, summer vacation. We don't actually get 2 months off over the summer. But wouldn't that be great?
I know. I mean, you know what? Let the kids enjoy their summer vacation because once they're adults, they only get PTO. Well, there's no such thing as summer vacation.
Okay, so maybe that's a question for you, Tamara. If you were someone who got 2 months off every year for summer vacation, what would you do?
Oh, and I can do whatever I want without money restrictions and stuff like that?
Well, I'm not saying that you are instantly a billionaire, but just that you have paid 2 months off every year.
Oh, like you're travel. Of course, travel.
Yeah, same.
You know what? I would visit every single continent. I would visit a bunch of countries. So yeah, travel.
Yeah, same. You could be our listener on Antarctica.
Ooh.
You could go and take an expedition to Antarctica and hook up to a satellite and download an episode of Bowel Sounds and tick that box for us.
Me and the penguins. Are there penguins on Antarctica?
Yeah.
Okay. So the penguins and I will listen to the episode.
That sounds good. That sounds good. I would also travel. There are a bunch of places that I have previously been in my younger, single, kidless life that I now would love to take my kids to go see. And then there are lots and lots and lots of countries that I've never been to before. And absolutely. Sign me up. Take me on a world tour. I would just go place to place.
That's amazing.
Well, as much as that dream is wonderful to think about, that's not reality. But we have an amazing episode today. We had the great pleasure of welcoming Dr. Charlie Vanderpool to the show to talk about a very important topic on infant nutrition.
And he's a superhero. Based on like what his children say,
right? We're giving
that can't catch birds, but runs faster than Batman.
Yeah, we're giving stuff away, but yes, all that to play for in today's episode. But so, like I said, the topic today is an important one on infant nutrition and specifically focusing on functional components in human breast milk and infant nutrition. And for people that don't know Charlie Vanderpool, he's a pediatric gastroenterologist at Riley Children's in Indianapolis, Indiana. And he has a special interest in pediatric intestinal failure and nutrition. He's a medical director of their nutrition support program. And he was an absolute fantastic guest for the show. And we can't wait for you guys to hear the interview.
Yeah, it's a great show. So you should listen. One, two, three.
On to the show. Oh, that was too big a pause. Dr. Charlie Vanderpool, welcome to Bowel Sounds.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome. We're excited to have you. You are just across the street from Cincinnati, right? You're in Indianapolis? That's pretty cool. How's the weather there?
Well, you know, we have Jason to blame for our air quality alerts right now and all the Canadian wildfires. So other than that, you know, weather's pretty good.
I have not been setting fires, just for the record. I can't be blamed for the entire country being on fire. It's really regrettable. It's a tough year for sure. So, Charlie, we're going to start with the question that our guests often find the most challenging, but it's also the most fun for us. And that's, for our listeners who don't know you, how would you describe yourself in one sentence?
Yeah, no, I tried to think of that because I don't know how I would describe myself other than just being a physician and a father. But so when I was thinking about it, I thought to myself, who would I want to know how they think of me or how they would describe me? And so probably I would think of my kids and how would they describe me. And I actually went through my office and went through my my desk and found their old Father's Day descriptions of me from years past. So I know I've listened to your podcast a few times, and I know a lot of people tend to give a run-on sentence for their description. So mine's going to be a little bit of a run-on, courtesy of my four kids. So the way they would describe me from their perspective is that I have superpowers. I can run faster than Batman, and I'm strong enough to lift a log. My favorite food is pizza. My favorite color is nothing. And I'm really good at feeding babies and taking care of babies, but I'm really bad at getting into a bunk bed and chasing and catching birds. So I'm really bad at that. But I'm loving and caring and nice, and I make them feel better because I let them have bubble gum. So, wow.
So I have so many follow-up questions. I think it in itself is going to be a whole podcast.
I know. But yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to unwrap there.
It is. So two questions. That's all.
Okay.
What superpowers do you have, and why are you bad at catching birds?
I was not aware. I am not a runner, so I don't know why I can run faster than Batman, but I can, I guess, according to my daughter.
Well, that's your superpower?
Batman's actually not that fast at running. He's got all
that's
of that gear
thought.
And
yeah.
a stiff suit, and you know, he's not about the running.
He's
so
just about the car.
I guess it's a lower bar to get over.
Yeah, and he's, you know, you could argue whether or not he's even really a, you know, a superhero.
True.
It's a low bar. You're gonna get some people mad here.
But catching birds is another one. I have no idea where that came from. And it's actually funny, on the little sheet that I got, it said, your father is not good at, and it said, I don't know what he's not good at, maybe catching birds. So
interesting. Wow. I don't know if that is a life goal to aspire to, but maybe you can still make that better. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll work on that.
my follow-up question is, why your favorite color is nothing?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just have a thing with being pegged down to a color, you know, like I like all colors. Or sometimes I'll say rainbow is my favorite color, but that's not really a color.
So I interpreted that totally differently. I thought that that meant not that you didn't necessarily have a favorite color, but that your favorite color was like transparent.
Yeah. Or I thought gray, maybe they're talking about like gray is kind of not really a color.
True.
But yeah, I don't know. So yeah, an interesting view into who I am according to my kids. So
no.
So Charlie, I think I passed through Indianapolis driving up to Chicago, but I've never been into Indianapolis. Jason wrote this question and he says, my only frame of reference is usually sports with the Indy 500 and the Colts.
Yep.
Is that correct?
I love being quoted while I'm sitting here. This is fantastic.
But what is there to do in Indianapolis? Like, I know I've wanted to go there one time for like an NBA game, but tell us more about Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I feel like Indy is kind of like Cincinnati. People know about some of the medical aspects. We have a lot of medical and pharmaceutical companies in Indy, but maybe tourism is a little tough to come by. I don't know. But yeah, Indy 500 is for sure the biggest thing that we have. And pretty much the entire month of May is the race. There's a mini marathon. There's a lot of concerts, practices. Like the track is kind of where it's at in Indy at May. And you can visit the track even throughout the year. There's other races there. So definitely racing is one of those. But a lot of people probably don't know that Indianapolis is home to the largest children's museum in the world.
Oh,
very cool.
Yeah. Sits on 30 acres. It has an indoor and an outdoor and experience. And Riley partners with the Children's Museum. And so our hospital has a lot of outdoor activities, physical activities, nutrition advice, and things that we do with the Children's Museum. So that's kind of another cool thing that we have. But I'd say downtown's the other thing, too, that they're really trying to build up the downtown area, both from things to do, things to where places to go and eat and things like that. So,
wow. OK, so now I have to plan a family trip to Indianapolis to check out the Children's Museum.
Yeah,
adults go to the Children's Museum.
Yeah. It's pretty fun, especially during the holidays. They'll do a lot of things, too. And then they have a lot of themes that come through. And a lot of those themes are things that even from our age when we were that age that we remember and kind of hold dear. So it is fun even for adults to go there with their kids.
Very cool. Awesome. So we could talk about children's museums and fun stuff to do and why your favorite color is nothing all day, but today
the audience wants to hear about the topic today.
I know, exactly. So we do have a topic, and we're going to talk about infant nutrition, which is a great topic. And we've previously had Dr. Mark Corkins on another episode. And in that episode, we talked about nutrition and environmental influences on health outcomes for children at various life stages, starting from the womb and progressing through childhood. We also talked about breastfeeding and formula feeding a bit, but we thought it'd be useful to really kind of drill down a bit more and really focus on infant nutrition, and specifically looking at the functional components of breast milk and formulas. And Charlie, you gave a great talk in a webinar, recent NASPGAN Wednesday webinar, and we'll put a link in the show notes to where people can still watch that if they're a NASPGAN member. And I think the title was Non-Nutrient Components of Diet in Infancy and Early Childhood. But maybe if we could just start by talking a little bit about when we talk about sort of non-nutrient components of diet, what we're actually talking about. I mean, they clearly have some nutritional value, but I guess they go beyond macro and micronutrients the way we traditionally think of them. And could you also give us some examples of what these are when we're talking about breast milk and infant formulas?
Yeah, no, that's a great question because you're right. A lot of the components of breast milk are nutrient-based. So they're proteins or carbohydrates, they're lipid-based. With the exception maybe being microbiome, which we'll talk about the human milk microbiome. But a lot of them are really not nutritive per se, in that they are either poorly digested or poorly absorbed. They pass through, but they have very direct roles in either nutrient absorption, or they have roles that extend beyond nutrient absorption or nutrition. So I think probably a better term would be functional additives of either infant formula or human milk, or the functional additives in human milk. Because they serve a function that goes beyond just nutrition. And whether that's promotion of health or well-being, or in pediatrics, we always talk about promotion of development and encouragement of development. And so I think it goes beyond, just like you said, those macro and micronutrients, the needs of the nutrition, that these additives are above and beyond that. So some people call them superfoods, or nutraceuticals is another one that they use. But these should be things that are normally present in the diet. They're not artificially added, that they can be consumed at levels that can actually lead to improvements or measurable improvements. And that then goes to the functionality of those foods, is that they're present, they're able to be taken in and lead to measurable improvements in one's health or well-being. And then with milk, with human milk, I think it's probably the ultimate superfood, is that we think it's so important for health, well-being, and nutrition of an infant. And a lot of those things that go in with human milk, the milk fat globule membrane, HMOs, or human milk oligosaccharides, lutein, lactoferrin, probiotics, prebiotics. There's so much to unpack there in human milk that I think it's really one of those great examples of what a true superfood is.
Yeah. I just love that we're going from superheroes to superfoods.
I know, right? Ooh, yeah.
A superhero talking about superfoods.
I know. And I could run in place really quick, you know, and demonstrate my speed while I talk too.
So you mentioned this, that fat is very important nutrition component in breast milk and in formula for growth, not just general growth, but brain development and kind of body growth for an infant. And there is kind of a difference between fat content and packaging between breast milk and traditional formulas. Can you tell us what the milk fat globule membrane is and why is it important and what is the evidence around that?
Milk fat globule membrane, or MFGM, you're right. It is very different than traditional formula. So traditional infant formula always takes a bovine fat-free milk base and then adds in typically vegetable oils into the milk. And human milk is very different. So human milk, just baseline, it does have fat in it, of course, but that fat is packaged in that mammary epithelial cell as a triglyceride core covered by a single layer membrane. And then as the epithelial cell is secreting that vesicle, it then takes on the double layer membrane from the epithelial apical membrane. And so that the fat globule is then encased in a trilayer membrane. And that trilayer membrane is the milk fat globule membrane, or MFGM. And so it's kind of a unique way to deliver lipids. It's thought that MFGM does play some role in fat absorption and fat delivery, but we think that probably the role of MFGM is more for its functional additives and the functional components of the membrane itself. So we think the membrane itself is important, but it's that components of the membrane that make a big difference. And those are phospholipids. So the membrane has a lot of phospholipids, and those are rich in choline, which are important for neurologic development and brain development. Sphingolipids, or sphingomyelin, is in this membrane, and that can be important for cell signaling, apoptosis, survival, neurologic development. And then very interesting is that human milk tends to be very high in cholesterol, and we think that cholesterol comes from this MFGM and its contents in that. And cholesterol is important in myelin formation and neurologic development as well. And then one of the other things, it's a carbohydrate and a fat component, is gangliosides and sialic acid are present in the MFGM as well. So all these little kind of components of the membrane itself are thought to have important roles. And with gangliosides and sialic acid, we think that promotes intestinal barrier function and intestinal development and neurologic development. So there are a lot of components of the membrane itself that extend function beyond just the delivery of the fat, which we can talk about. The fat itself is important, but the components of that membrane, we think, have really important functions in and of themselves.
So that sounds like it's a real value add on top of just vegetable oil, because obviously we think of fat as being a major contributor for energy and calories for a growing infant, but if the wrapper around the fat contributes so much to brain development and potentially gut health as well, that's a really big deal.
Yeah, and formula companies are starting to pick up on this. And so I think one thing that's always really helpful for me is that if I'm in the store and doing something, I'll just stroll down the formula aisle. And you'll start seeing a lot on formulas MFGM listed on the product labeling, and that this is something that is being added to formula. It's probably within the last 5 years or so that this has really become more mainstream. And they've looked at this, and it's always hard with these studies because some studies will add the MFGM, but they add bovine MFGM. So it's different than human. So it's not completely translatable to what we may see with human milk. But we think there's still important functional components of bovine MFGM. But studies have looked at improvements in IQ testing, different infections and infection rates. And there seems to be improvement, but it's hard because these studies are really expensive to give someone a study formula. And so the intervention oftentimes is different between the studies. They may only look at intervention formula to a standard formula. They may or may not compare it to human milk. And so it is pretty hard to really draw a lot of conclusions from some of these studies, but it seems like there is at least some improvement in IQ testing or components of IQ or cognitive improvements. And then barrier function of the intestine, looking at infection rates. There seems to be some benefit to adding this to formula. but compared to human milk, it's not always as marked of an improvement, or that the improvements may not be retained as long as people with who are fed or breastfed human milk.
So throughout breastfeeding within the months, so if mom's breastfeeding 1 month versus 2 months versus 3 months versus six gotcha. Months versus yep. a year, does the MFGM concentration vary? And, you know, sometimes parents are able to breastfeed for 2 months and then they have to do an exclusive formula feeding. Would the infant get enough MFGM for kind of neurological development?
Yeah. So we think that there are components of human milk that change based on lactation stage, for sure. HMO content, which we'll talk about, DHA content. So some of those functional additives do change. And I would say DHA is an example of that, where the fat content of the MFGM particle may change. But we think that the MFGM component itself is probably one of the a little bit more static, like it's not as changing as much as some of the other functional additives of breast milk, because it is just part of that production process. And so I think you're right in thinking like some of that fat content, other functional additives do change based on lactation age, but probably the MFGM component itself is a little bit more of a static. So they do tend to get exposure to MFGM regardless of when they are or where they are at in lactation stage.
So moving on from MFGM, did I get yep. that right?
Yep.
We'll talk about yet another acronym, and this is the human milk oligosaccharide. So maybe we can consider it, you know, the other HMO. And obviously, it's right there in the name, but there are differences between human and bovine milks when it comes to these compounds. And so why might that matter?
Yeah, I think this highlights really an important concept in general, is that the functional additives in human milk are human functional milk components. And then a lot of things that we add are either synthetic or bovine in origin. And the homology or the similarity between those are not always there. We think that the human milk has up to 100 or 1,000 fold higher HMO content compared to bovine milk. And that we think that there's probably over 200 HMOs in human milk. So human milk oligosaccharides is the third largest component of human milk behind lactose and fat. And so it's a huge component of milk. It may even, in a lot of people, outpace protein content of milk. That HMO content is above the amount of protein in human milk. But there is those differences in bovine versus human milk HMO. The other thing that I think is important to keep in mind, too, is that you'll see these on another one you'll see on formula labels, is that they're adding in HMO content. They talk about HMOs. The most common one that I have seen in formula is 2-fucosyl lactose, or 2FL. And it is the most common HMO in human milk. Some people estimate 20 to 30% of HMO content is 2FL. But there's over 200 HMOs in human milk. And so can we really expect to replicate the benefits of human milk by adding in one or sometimes two? Some formulas will add in two HMOs, which are either bovine or synthetic in origin. So we know HMOs provide a number of benefits. They can have anti-adhesive or antimicrobial properties. They're prebiotics, so they can promote microbiome development. They do aid in mucosal barrier function, immune regulation. So there's a lot of important aspects of HMOs. And data has supported their use as, one, safe, two, good growth with HMO addition. And there's been some reduction in infectious illness rates, not universal all infections, but some respiratory infections have been reduced with HMO addition. Antibiotic and antipyretic use can be reduced when HMOs are added to formula. So I think there is benefits to adding HMO, and I think it's an exciting aspect of formula development. But definitely those caveats, like you mentioned, that it's not the same as human milk, and they're not human in origin typically. They're either bovine or synthetic.
It's kind of surprising to hear that these HMOs, which I probably started to see on formula labels within the last 10 years, maybe. It's certainly not a longstanding angle that I've seen on formula cans or bottles, is such a big component of human milk, you know, third, right? Like that's yeah. a pretty substantial
shocking.
Component.
Yeah. yeah.
And, yeah. and so it is, you know, important to note how big a deal HMO is, but also the fact that it's so complex and that there are so many different varieties within human breast milk. And it, you know, we're going to circle back to talking about the microbiome later, but it sort of sounds like another area in which we're trying to replicate extreme complexity by following a pretty simplistic approach of, you know, trying to pull one lever at a time. And, yeah. But at the same time, I guess the one last comment I would make and see what you think is when we're talking about infant formulas as being an infant's best option for nutrition when breastfeeding simply either isn't an option or doesn't work for the family, then some move in that direction is probably better than traditional or kind of old school formulas.
Yeah. No, I think it is exciting. I think it's an exciting field in general. These functional additives, as we're learning more and more. I think we're learning more and more about human milk, which I think is extremely important. And I think it's important to know about these additives because it really highlights, like you said, the complexity of human milk, but that there probably is a role for a lot of these in infant formula and is an exciting development, you know, in infant formula use.
So we talked about fat. We talked about oligosaccharides. Let's talk about protein and specifically lactoferrin, which is a particular whey protein. It has many functions beyond just simply being a dietary protein. Can you tell us a little bit more about what lactoferrin's function is?
Yeah, so lactoferrin, I think a lot of us as gastroenterologists are familiar with lactoferrin as a neutrophil protein. So just like calprotectin, it's involved in the inflammatory process and response and colitis. But I think it's also important. One thing that I learned early on, and every once in a while you get this referral of a formula-fed or breastfed infant who has blood in the stool and the primary doctor checks the lactoferrin and is positive. So on top of being a neutrophil protein that's poorly digested and measurable in the stool, it's also a human milk protein that is also poorly digested and measurable in the stool. So it does serve other functions beyond just protein intake, but it is, like you said, one of the more predominant whey proteins in human milk. And we think it has a diverse function. But one reason why you can't rely on that lactoferrin in an infant is because it is being added much more frequently to infant formula and, of course, is a common component of whey protein in human milk. But lactoferrin is known to have antimicrobial properties. That's why we think it's involved in the inflammatory response. So it can break down cell walls. It can coordinate with lysozyme and break down cell walls. It can prevent biofilm formation. So really important on adhesive and anti-adhesive properties. And then interestingly, we think it can sequester iron too. So we're not really sure what that role is in iron homeostasis for the infant, but we think that sequestration of iron could play a role in its bacteriostatic properties. So it kind of keeps the iron away from bacteria. And so in general, it's thought to be primarily an anti-infective protein and important in some of those reduced infection rates that we see. And we've looked at it in formula, adding to formula alone, but a lot of studies will also have it in addition to something else. And one of the common ones that I've seen it added is with MFGM, looking at it in studies. And studies have shown a reduced rate of certain infections. Again, typically otitis or respiratory infection, lower respiratory infections. And there are reduced rates of that. But just like with everything, the intervention time is different, follow-up time is different, the study comparisons may be different between studies. But I do think, again, this is one of those functional additives that I think has a role in infant formula and is kind of another exciting example of formula advancement.
Also, really good tip about measuring lactoferrin levels in infants on formula who are being breastfed and might be receiving lactoferrin in other ways.
Yes. Yeah.
So we briefly touched on the microbiome. And of course, the microbiome continues to be a very hot topic within gastroenterology. I don't think you can attend a meeting, a conference, watch a presentation where microbiome isn't mentioned at least once. I think if you have microbiome on your bingo card, you're going to do well at pretty yes. much every meeting. And there's a good reason why. We know that the microbiome has a large number of either proven or postulated links between it and health growth, developmental outcomes, and it's certainly been postulated to have very strong influences on growth and developmental outcomes in infants and children. What do we know about the microbiome within human breast milk? You mentioned the breast milk microbiome itself and how this might influence the infant microbiome.
Now, I think that's one thing that is it's important to keep in mind is that I think both are very important. The human milk microbiome is one thing, and then the infant microbiome, I think, is extremely important. And we know that there's two major factors to infant microbiome, the delivery method, whether they're vaginal or C-section delivery, and then their feeding pattern, whether they're breastfed or bottle fed. And years ago, it was thought that human milk was sterile, and we just didn't have the ability to check microbiome analysis in the human milk itself. And then when we started to realize there was bacteria in milk, some people blamed the oral pharyngeal bacteria from the infant who was feeding. But we now know that there is a huge amount. Some people estimate tens of thousands of bacteria per ml in human milk, or microbes, I guess, not necessarily just bacteria. And that we know that the human milk microbiome varies from mother to mother. It's based on lactation stage. So one of those that does vary based on the lactation age of the mother, geography of the mother, BMI, socioeconomic status, medications that they may be on. So there's a lot of factors that can change the human milk microbiome. And that we know that that human milk microbiome helps shift the infant microbiome more towards those lactobacillus, staphylococcus, bifidobacterium, and away from some of those more pro-inflammatory microbiomes that we see in formula-fed infants. So I think it's one of those very important components, the human milk microbiome. Where is its level of importance compared to other things? It's so hard to know. You know, that's, to me, one of the strange things about microbiome research is that it could be responsible for everything or we have no way to change it consistently. So it's hard to know exactly where it ranks in the, but I think it's up there. I think it's one of the more important aspects of human milk. And we know that that microbiome and the changes in microbiome affect growth patterns and energy utilization. So we think it's one of the reasons why infants who are breastfed may be able to utilize energy at a higher rate. Plays a role in the development of the infant microbiome, so the stool microbiome of the infant, which then is involved in the gut-lung axis development and risk of atopic disease or asthma, the brain-gut axis and developing neurotransmitters, and the gut lymphoid, the GALT, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and the immune response. So that first exposure to microbes is through the human milk, and it really sets that stage for the infant microbiome and developing more of a beneficial microbiome pattern compared to formula-fed infants.
That is very interesting. I wonder, it might be hard to study this, but microbiome in IQ, that would be a very interesting kind of thing to look into. But also, one thing I wanted to ask about is, what about pre- and probiotics? Is there any value for that for infants that are formula or breastfed? And is there any evidence about the utilization of pre- and postbiotics on the microbiome or on anything else?
Yeah. To your first question, I guess, on the IQ, I think is an interesting question. We do know that microbiome and the infant microbiome and maternal microbiome is associated with important cognitive developments. They've looked at it, I think, more with ADHD. So there is an increased risk of ADHD based on your microbiome. And then certain neuropsychiatric disorders as well are associated with microbial changes. I think there is some data on cognitive development and cognitive outcomes and microbiome analysis, but I think the bulk of the research has looked at disease states or other mental health or mental or cognitive disorders compared to the microbiome. So interesting research. I think it is something that we need to learn more about. And then to your question about probiotics, probiotics in infant formula is one. So one of my roles here at Riley is the medical director of nutrition support. And a lot of that is involved in what formula will we have here in the hospital. And I always struggle with probiotics in infant formula because compared to human milk is dynamic. We know it changes. We know the human microbiome changes in response to environmental cues. We know it is typically given fresh or it's given in a way that is not weeks or months old. And adding probiotics to formula, I always struggle with that, but there is some decent data on it, but there are important differences too. So compared to human milk, adding probiotics to formula, it's typically one or two strains. So it's very strain specific. It's not dynamic. It doesn't change. And it has to be at least somewhat stable over a longer period of time. So there are some important differences to keep in mind. Most probiotics in formula are either Lactobacillus or Bifidobacterium, which are important human milk strains, but fairly static compared to human milk. And I think the other thing that is hard with probiotic research is that it will vary based on if they're giving the probiotic itself or if the probiotic is added to the formula. So there is some data on probiotics and reducing the risk of necrotizing enterocolitis in preterm infants. But a lot of those studies have looked at primarily specific strains given to the preterm infant themselves. So probiotics added to formula, there's a little bit less research on that. They're generally regarded as safe to add probiotics, but there have been studies that have looked at crying time and reduction of crying time, stool frequency, stool consistency. There have been some studies that look at improving outcomes in milk protein intolerance when added to an extensively hydrolyzed formula. So for the most part, probiotics are thought to be safe. They're thought to be a safe additive to formula. It's becoming harder and harder to find formula without probiotics added, which is something we struggle with in the hospital. But I do think there is some data for it. But it is, again, one of those things that's important to know the differences in human milk versus formula, that there is just very important differences between the two.
Right. And maybe if I could just tack on a follow-up, you know, probiotics is obviously sort of wave one of trying to influence the microbiome. And then we got a little bit smarter and started thinking about prebiotics and how do we just provide the food for beneficial organisms. And you mentioned, you know, when we talked about HMOs, but are there any other prebiotic sources that are sometimes added to formulas that might help influence the microbiome?
Yeah, I would say HMOs are probably the biggest one that we use. There are others that they, different sugars, different carbohydrates, sialic acid is one that they use, and then modulation. So even by maybe not a strict definition as it is, we think that some of the functional additives, although not kind of strict prebiotics, by altering the host immune response, anti-adhesive properties, trying to select out for certain types of bacteria, we think a lot of the functional additives really can help shift the microbiome in a more beneficial way. And so I would say a lot of them have some effect on the microbiome, whether it's through direct prebiotic effect and promoting the growth of healthy bacteria versus reducing some of those more pathogenic bacteria and infections as well, and reducing antibiotic use and need for that as well.
Kind of a more holistic influence rather than, you know, specific push among different populations.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah.
Shifting a little bit away from pre and probiotics to back to some fat talk. Now, we know that omega-3 fats are important in development of our nervous system. How do infants get those important components, whether it's from human breast milk or from formula? And specifically on the formula side, I know a lot is being made of formulas with DHA added to them. And, you know, what's the evidence behind specifically adding DHA to formula?
So this is fat and fat characterization and nomenclature is always one I struggle with. Traditionally, formula contained the essential fats. So I always have to try and remember, what are my essential fats and are they omega-6 or omega-3? So linoleic acid is one of your, and then alpha-linolenic are your two essential fats. Linoleic acid is an omega-6 fatty acid, and alpha-linolenic is an omega-3 fatty acid. And so these fats and their byproducts are what we call the long-chain PUFAs or the LC PUFAs. And those byproducts are what a lot of that interest you mentioned, DHA content, that's byproducts of essential fat degradation or metabolism. We think infants are really immature in that pathway, so they can metabolize their essential fats. And of course, they're essential for a reason. They need to have them as part of their diet. But we think that their metabolism pathways are relatively immature. And so it's very beneficial for them to have those direct metabolism byproducts, DHA, EPA, ARA. And probably the one that we look at the most is DHA, because we know that DHA is incorporated in the brain and the eyes. So we think it's important for neurocognitive and visual development. We know that it's accrued during the third trimester and during that early postnatal period. So the first 6 months of life is the biggest time period we think is important for DHA. And you accrue it after that, but we think the highest rate of accrual is during those first or early months postnatally as well. And you can get it in the diet. It's a little bit hard, especially in a Western diet. So fish and oily fishes are your best source of DHA. And so a lot of recommendations for supplementation and breastfeeding in pregnant mothers. So tying back to the MFGM, these are those fats that are within that milk fat globule membrane core. So these fats are in that core delivered by the MFGM and are important in and of themselves for development and well-being. So traditionally, formula used to not contain specific DHA. It just contained those essential fats. And then it became clear, just with additional knowledge, that it may be beneficial to add those fats directly in for accrual. And there's probably a little bit more data in the preterm infant and the importance of that. In term infants, the data has been a little bit mixed. So right now, probably since the 80s and 90s, really all formula contains DHA. And the amount of DHA that formula contains approximates that of breast milk. So it's very similar. Now, human milk, this is another one that varies based on age, socioeconomic status, diet. But formula now almost all throughout the world contains DHA. But the data on it, especially in the term infant, isn't the greatest. There are some studies that show improvement in markers of visual acuity. But a lot of studies do not. There are some studies that show improvement in neurocognitive outcomes based on Bayley scores or other neurocognitive tests, but some studies do not. And so a lot of like the meta-analyses and Cochrane analyses have really not been able to draw definite conclusions that DHA is beneficial. But it's regarded as safe and it's thought that it is important. And so it has continued to remain a mainstay of formula and one of those functional additives within formula. But its exact role or how important it is, especially in the term infant, is one of those that's still a little bit to be determined.
It seems like we've learned a lot about what the importance of some of the functional components of breast milk or human breast milk and infant formulas are. What do you see as being some of the remaining big questions that are still unanswered?
I love these kinds of questions because, one, I'd love to hear what you guys think, too. But I think for me, when I go through this and when I've learned about a lot of these functional additives, read about them, educated myself about them, to me, I think one of the biggest unanswered questions is, what is the role of these in formula? And how do we balance the importance of formula development and formula marketing with cost? And I would say cost extends much more beyond the monetary cost. To me, it has illustrated to me how dynamic human milk is. But then also when you read about this, you almost are compelled to look at human milk and breastfeeding rates. And I don't know, Jason, how it is in Canada, but here in the U.S., our breastfeeding rates, we think that about 20% or less of mothers exclusively breastfeed for 6 months, which is the AAP recommendation, and that at 12 months, probably 30% or less of mothers breastfeed at all. And so I don't know first the demographics of that is it tends to be individuals with a higher socioeconomic status, higher education. And so the people who have to pay for formula are people who tend to be of the lower socioeconomic status, lower education. And so that there is monetary cost, I think, to some of this. You know, these studies to look at this, to evaluate the improvements seen in formula are expensive. Marketing is expensive. So that cost is passed off to the consumer and the government subsidies or the government programs that help provide that cost too. So I think there definitely is monetary cost questions on how much improvement are we seeing? And is it justify the cost impact to the consumer? But I think to me, even the more important question is, what is the cost to overall infant health and well-being? So we all have infants and patients who need formula. So I'm a big proponent of breastfeeding and human milk. I have plenty of patients that I have and treat who need formula, either for health reasons, socioeconomic reasons, working, you know, mothers who need to supplement. But where does formula fit in and the marketing, the belief that we're making formula better? How does that fit into our breastfeeding rates? Because I really think human milk and breastfeeding is probably one, if not the most important early determinant of infant mortality. And I think probably also one of the most important determinants of long-term health and well-being in our children. And so to me, I would say the cost of all of this, and I don't want it to just be about money. I think it's where does it fit in and how does it fit in with marketing, and how are we portraying formula? How are we portraying these improvements? And what is the cost of that in health and well-being to our children as they grow up?
I just wanted to ask a follow-up question about that. And I'm sure breastfeeding moms or moms who've had babies understand that breastfeeding is important, but I can't help to think that kind of what you said is a little bit anxiety provoking to some mothers that really want to breastfeed, but feel like they are not able to for the reasons that you said.
For whatever reason.
Or whatever reason, they just don't want to breastfeed. What can you tell them that would ease their mind and not make them feel guilty? Because I have a lot of moms that come in and their infant has been suffering with milk protein allergy, not growing well, and the mom really wants to continue breastfeeding, but the mom is tired, the baby's tired, everybody in the family's tired, and putting the mom on milk-free diet, and sometimes milk and soy, and that's kind of stressful to them. So sometimes we need to tell them that maybe the best decision right now is to stop breastfeeding. So what would you tell those moms that hear you say breastfeeding is very important for the development of the brain and the mind and everything else, but they can't breastfeed?
Yeah. Well, first thing I say is that I was formula fed and I'm a superhuman who can run faster than Batman. So I just start out there, you know, but no, I to be perfectly honest, I was formula fed. And so you are absolutely right. There are mothers who honestly have given it a try, and for whatever reason, whether it's medical, whether it's social, whether it's whatever, it doesn't work out. And so, yeah, I think as medical providers, our job is to not judge, but to try and promote the health and well-being of the patient and of the family unit. And I think that's incredibly important. And so, yeah, I always tell mothers, if especially in those cases where you're looking at exclusion diets, there's so much more that goes into neurocognitive development than just nutrition. And that's coming from a nutrition doctor. So I think that nutrition is important, but nurturing is just as important. And so you have to be a nurturing mother. You have to be a happy mother. You have to be a happy father. You know, the family unit is extremely important, and that a one size fits all is never appropriate for any patient or any family. That's why I think some of these functional additives are important. I think we have to be honest with what they are, where they come from, and make sure families are making those educated decisions based on facts and not based on clever marketing ploys. So I think that's one thing, but you're absolutely right. You know, like, I am a big proponent of human milk and breastfeeding. We have supplemented all of our kids. My wife is a working mother, and stay-at-home mothers are working mothers. So that is extremely important to keep in mind through all of this, is that that there are exciting developments within formula. We're still judging it to a dynamic, amazing food and human milk. And I think we'll continue to get better. But I think we just be upfront with our families and provide them with the care that helps improve the health and well-being, not only of the infant, but of the family unit as a whole.
I think that's really, really important. And maybe what I was going to tack on to that, and this could also be controversial and unpopular in some segments, but you asked about breastfeeding rates in Canada, and I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but I do strongly suspect that it's quite a bit higher than the numbers that you quoted. And part of that has to do with universal maternity leave.
Yes.
So paid maternity leave for
up to
2 years.
Can we add on 30
years?
Minutes to the podcast?
Yeah. Yeah. So and
paternity leave is
and parental leave as well, right? And so I'll just throw out there that another important piece that is very difficult to influence, but our listeners could certainly work on that, is those social pressures that make breastfeeding more challenging for mothers to engage in, and then add to the sort of stress and anxiety that Tamara was bringing up. Because if you are expected to go back to work at the 6-week mark, how are you going to establish a
yes.
breastfeeding practice, you know? And like you, Charlie, I always tell, you know, mothers who are stressing out about being able to continue with breastfeeding, be able to exclusively breastfeed, I always say, you know, to the extent that you are willing and able, anything you do is of value to your child. And so even if you're only able to partially breastfeed, even if you're only able to breastfeed to 2 months or 3 months, that is still something you're doing for your infant, and that is of value, and not to stress about what you're not able to do. But it's really hard to imagine being able to establish, you know, exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months, continued yeah. breastfeeding for a year when moms are going back to work at 6 weeks. So just throwing out that, you know, potentially unpopular opinion from a neighbor to the north.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I agree with you, Jason. You bring up an important point. We talk about advocacy a lot and healthcare, and there are a lot of NASPGAN opportunities for that. I think one thing that's overlooked is some of those aspects of breastfeeding that go and be above and beyond just the breastfeeding. Like to me, when I walk through the hospital and I see one of my female colleagues going into a restroom to pump, I think it's just insulting. And we don't even have healthcare coverage for pumping supplies or universal healthcare coverage for things to even help assist people to be successful. When we know human milk can reduce incidence of disease. And so, yeah, I could go on and on. I mean, we could talk about this for, like I said, another 20 or 30 minutes. And, but yeah, I think, Tamara, to your point, like you need to treat the patient, but as pediatricians, we all know we need to treat the family too. And that there are exciting improvements in formula. I don't want this to be interpreted in any way that I'm down on formula. Because again, I can run faster than Batman. I can lift a log, and I was formula fed. So,
but you can't catch a bird. Yeah.
And I can't catch it. You know, I can't catch a bird.
If you try hard, you might be able to.
So, yeah, no, a very, very important point. I'm glad you brought that up, because it is something that we have to, and I have this conversation often with mothers, is that we have to make sure that we're caring for everybody in the family.
So, Charlie, just taking a step away from nutrition and formula and breastfeeding for just a moment, if you were to look back at your career, what has been the most valuable advice that you've received, and what advice do you have for our listeners?
Yeah, so I've definitely been blessed to have amazing mentors through my career. I did my training at Vanderbilt, and I could list a number of the mentors through Vanderbilt. And then just here at Riley for the last 11 years, I've just been blessed with so many mentors. And I was trying to think of like some amazing career advice that I could give listeners. And I was really struggling. I just feel like there's so many mentors that have given me just day-to-day advice. But when I thought about advice, and I don't know if it's just who I am, but really the advice that has always stuck out to me has been the advice about just being a human and being a father, being a husband. And like to me, the mentors that I think have meant the most to me, Joe Fitzgerald is one of the pioneers of pediatric gastroenterology here in the States. And I would just go to him when he was here before he retired and ask him about his relationship with his wife. And they're married for now well over 50 years. And I asked him what to get my wife for our 10th year wedding anniversary. Gave me great advice, a diamond. You know, that's probably fairly straightforward advice, but even just like how to go about that and what it means and how to be a good husband and how to try and balance that. And then the other one that stuck out to me is just in talking with Jean Molliston, who's our division director here, about just struggles that my wife is going through in her academic position, and how to navigate that as a woman, and how to navigate conflicts in the business place, and getting advice for people in my family. And so to me, my advice would be just be willing to seek out advice above and beyond your career about being a better human, about being a better husband, wife, spouse. And don't be afraid to be vulnerable with your mentors and let them know what you're struggling with and how they can help. Because I think we're all invested in each other's careers, no doubt. But I want to see my mentees succeed as humans. And so I would just encourage everyone to just be honest, be open, and just seek to be a better person and a better human.
I think that's really good advice, to remember that we are more than our careers.
That's great. That's amazing. So, Charlie, it's been great having you on this podcast. You gave us a lot of great information. what are three main takeaway points for the listeners to remember from this podcast?
I would say three main points is that human milk is dynamic and has much more to offer than just calories, and that we are learning more and more about what that means. So probably the second point is that there are important functional additives that extend beyond nutrition, beyond calories, and that those functional additives are now being added to infant formula. So I think it's a really exciting time in development, exciting time in nutrition, that a lot of these are backed by true science. And I think it's a really exciting time.
Yeah. That's great. That's great.
Sounds
Those
great.
Those are great points. We've been lucky to have you today, the superhero of nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite food is pizza. So I don't know if that like just totally destroys my street cred. I don't know. But
no. All foods can
vegetables.
Fit.
Just say pizza with vegetables on it. And
that
then
is
you
true.
Just, like, you're eating your vegetables.
That is true. That is true. I'll just get the Supreme.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us, Charlie.
Yep.
Thank you for your time. We appreciate you.
So that was a absolutely amazing conversation with Charlie about infant nutrition. I think we raised a lot of important topics about infant nutrition, and also maybe some advocacy things for people to take away and work on among our membership and members of AAP and other organizations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Bowel Sounds, and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. If you like what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would really help us if you did one or all of the following things. Number one, tell one person about the podcast. Two, leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover the podcast. And three, on our Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. You can also get there through www.naspgan.org. The money you donate helps support some of the amazing things that the NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, including supporting pediatric GI research and public education programs.
As always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the hosts and guests and are subject to change with advances in the field.
Thank you all for listening.
Bye for now, everyone.